Then if you could find me some clothes, I would appreciate it.
Very well. But how are you feeling?
The fairy asked.
Are you ready to leave?
Well enough, I said. After she departed, I hauled myself out and checked a bit more thoroughly. Most of the internal organ damage was mended, because that was always a priority of healing. But my muscle tissue in my back and right leg was still tight at best, and remained torn in places. I would have to limp for a while and eat some protein to repair that more quickly. And in truth, I could use some more time in the pool, but time I didn't have. I also didn't have any idea of what happened to Werner Drosche after his arrest. Was he still locked up, or did he escape? And where was Oberon? Did you remember to get that binder out of the hotel room in Toronto?
No. Was that important? I told Owen to bring the sword.
Thank you for that, sincerely. You deserve a snack.
Heck yes, I do.
But the binder was important, too. I wonder if it's still there. I mean, I didn't check out, so it should be.
I will go with you, and you can lean on me as you limp.
Thanks, buddy.
And I'll show you where the poutine is.
Excellent. The fairy appeared to say that Briett would arrive soon, and gave me a white fluffy robe that had obviously been stolen from a hotel on Earth. The logo was still embroidered on the breast. I'd been hoping for something like pants and a shirt, but I guessed I could suffer the stares I would get walking through Toronto in a robe. I would go to the front desk, ask for a key to my room because I'd lost it, and then they would ask me, oh no. My ID was in my clothes, which Owen left at the hospital.
Oops.
It wasn't an insurmountable problem. I could still get into the room by unbinding the lock, but the identity of Sean Flanagan would have to be retired permanently. There would be plenty of questions for the gunshot victim who disappeared. I mentally reviewed what else I had to do before I took off to Svartalfheim, perhaps never to return. I wished I could check in with Granuaile. I hadn't heard from her since I left for Ethiopia. All I knew was that she was in Asgard, and therefore very difficult to reach at the moment. I hoped she was well. But since reconnecting with her would be impossible, there was one other matter to see to in England. Briett arrived before I could make plans, looking annoyed. It turned out not to be annoyance with me, however. She had loads on her mind after Fan's revolt. And, much to my surprise, she had no problem whatsoever with me going to Svartalfheim at the Morrigan's urging.
She gave me the same message,
she said. She did?
Via Owen, yes. He relayed the message, and I'll go with you. Tomorrow, then, at dawn.
Yeah, I said. Her quick agreement knocked me off balance. But you'll want to wear the super-tough armor.
Oh, I will. Would you like some for yourself?
I hadn't worn armor in centuries, but against dwarfs, it might be handy, especially in my condition. Do you have any that would fit me?
I can get you something that will serve,
she said, a tiny smile on her face. Great. At dawn. Briett departed, and Oberon and I left soon afterward. For the record, Toronto is a wonderfully diverse city, and people are used to seeing all types. But a limping man wearing nothing but a robe and a sword will draw attention. Oberon carried the stake in his mouth because it looked innocent there. If I carried it, I might look like I planned to stab someone, and the sword was already giving that impression. I was unclear on just how much time I had spent in the healing pools, but it was morning again in Toronto, and we passed by the same Timmies we had before. Ed and his companion were there, sipping their coffee and watching the world go by, though I didn't realize it was them until the first man spoke up as we passed.
Boy, you never know what you're going to see in Toronto, Ed.
Yep.
Ed was the best color commentator in the business. We took the elevator to the 6th floor, where I took the time to bypass the lock on my room. It turned out to be gloriously undisturbed. The binder was there, and so was my backpack, and a very welcome change of clothes. open-ended stays with a reliable credit card on file can be wonderful. If the police were monitoring the financial records of Sean Flanagan, checking out would let the police know that I was still alive. That was fine. They'd never hear from him again, because I'd be getting a new identity from Hal. The hospital could have my old ID. Once outside and walking back to Queen's Park, I had to break the news to Oberon that the Poutinerie wasn't open yet, and I didn't have any money anyway. We would have to snaffle something to eat elsewhere. Let's head over to the UK. It's mid-afternoon there, that dead time of the day in pubs when cooks are either cleaning the kitchen or taking breaks. They're not hovering over the food, in other words. Should be able to lift a few bangers without any trouble.
Can we get a haggis in Scotland?
Ugh, we can try. We shifted across the Atlantic to a wee place north of Dumfries, where I found one of those small country hotels that doubles as a pub near the bound grove of trees we used. They did not have haggis, a small mercy. But they did have some lamb ready to go, and a camouflaged sneak into the kitchen gave us a much-needed repast. They had an herb garden and a greenhouse out back, and it was doing all right, but could be better. I spent some time mending the soil there as payment for our food. They would never recognize that they'd been paid, but it was a salve for my conscience. I already had enough evils clinging to my back, and didn't need to carry around petty theft as well. Belly's full. We shifted south to a grove near Windsor Castle, where I followed the instructions Hermes had given me to summon the West Wind if I wanted to get in touch with Olympus. The globe-trotting was wearying, especially when I needed a few days more to heal, but I felt that neglecting this duty before traveling to Svartalfheim would be an egregious error. Little Lord Anklewings himself streaked out of the southern sky after about an hour, coming to a halt some 5 feet off the ground. Hermes, I said, nodding to him.
Druid, what do you want?
I'd love to set Diana free, if she'll agree to terms, I said. The Roman goddess of the hunt had been cut into sections and imprisoned in rock because she'd vowed never to rest before she killed both Granuaile and me. Artemis had agreed to live and let live, but Diana held on to one hell of a grudge. But I would like Jupiter to be present. We agreed we'd visit her monthly, and at this point I'm a bit late and don't want to let it go any longer. I know Mercury usually delivers such messages to Jupiter, but would you mind relaying the request? I'm about to leave the plane tomorrow, and I would hate for Diana to miss her chance at freedom.
Wait here. I'll deliver your message.
He flew away without any further pleasantries. In another hour, as the sun was sinking red into the west, Jupiter struck the earth as a thunderbolt nearby and startled Oberon and me out of our skins.
He didn't have to make his entrance like that, right, Atticus?
No.
So he's kind of like one of those cats that walks up and takes a swipe at your nose with his claws just because he can?
Yes.
I don't like those cats.
Jupiter was fully armored, or at least armored by Roman standards, which left the legs somewhat vulnerable, though he did have greaves. His dark, oiled beard jutted out below his helmet like a column of basalt, and lightning sparked in his eyes and in his fists. I thought we might be in trouble.
Don't worry. This show isn't for you, he said. It's for Diana. I want her to see how very displeased I am.
An excellent idea. In my Latin headspace, I called to the elemental of England, Albion, and requested that he bring Diana's various parts up out of the earth so that we may talk to her. I continued to speak to Jupiter in the other. May I offer a suggestion that might also urge her to accept a truce? The Roman god of the sky nodded, and I continued. I'll remain out of sight, and you talk to her. Please relay my offer that the druids will speak to Gaia and take special care of the grove in which the dryads live. We'll be sure the trees flourish, in other words, and their dryads along with them. I sincerely regret the unpleasantness and want to make it right. So long as I secure her pledge not to hunt me or have others seek my death.
Understood.
He nodded once, and then asked,
"What news regarding this Ragnarok business?"
"We're still in the opening moves of the chess match. I'm leaving tomorrow to try to secure a new ally, the Dark Elves of Svartalfheim. It's why I wish to do this now. I'm not sure when or even if I'll be back." The earth parted between us, and Diana emerged. Severally. I stepped back behind her head, or I suppose at the top of her head where she couldn't see me. She had an excellent view of Jupiter, though, which must have been very intimidating.
"Welcome back to the light, Diana," he said. "I hope it will be permanent. The druids are offering concessions, and I hope you will consider carefully, because it specifically addresses the injury you claim to be fighting for."
Diana's confident voice contained a bite of scorn. She had not been cowed by nearly 2 months of solitary confinement in the darkness. Mortals would have broken in mere days, but not an Olympian.
"Go on, then," she said.
"They will protect the dryads and their groves, and make sure that they flourish with the strength of Gaia, and they sincerely regret inspiring your anger. All that they ask is that you allow them to live, and do not conspire against them."
The goddess of the hunt did not answer, and Jupiter eventually had to prompt her, eyes flashing.
"Well, what say you? You go free and the dryads will be better off."
"I accept."
The thunder god's expression softened, and the lightning in his eyes faded.
"This pleases me. Swear to me that you will abide by the conditions of your release. You will no longer hunt the druids, and will not seek to bring them harm by any other means."
"I swear all this in your name."
"Good."
His eyes flicked up in my direction, and I asked Albion to set Diana free. The chalky soil native to the area crumbled away, allowing Jupiter to reattach Diana's limbs and head to her torso. From there, the divine healing abilities of the Olympian immortals took over, and in minutes she was whole again. Jupiter helped her up. She brushed some dirt and dust off her arms and clothes, and then turned to see me, standing there with Oberon. She clenched her jaw, and then her fists, and I immediately regretted not casting camouflage, as the mere sight of me was a clear provocation to her. Such a provocation that a cry of rage ripped loose from her throat, and she charged me barehanded. I drew Fragora, which set off spasms of pain all down my back, tried to set myself on a gammy leg, and warned Oberon to stay out of the way.
"Diana!"
Jupiter shouted.
"You swore!"
She kept coming. I readied a low swing at her midsection, something she couldn't duck. And then Diana exploded into golden ichor and organ chunks, and Oberon and I both got covered in her viscera and cut up with little pieces of bone shrapnel. A crack of thunder accompanied the explosion and explained what happened. Jupiter had obliterated her with a thunderbolt, rather than see her break her word.
"Ow! Dang it! I just had a bath!"
"Oberon, do not lick any of that off. Ichor is poison to us. Let it sit and we'll wash you as soon as we can." Jupiter growled a few choice curses in Latin, and then apologized in English.
"Sorry about that. I thought she would keep to her word."
"Blech.
I thought so too."
"I'll deal with her on Olympus,"
he said, for she would respawn there after a while. The Olympians had a pretty sweet immortality deal compared to most other pantheons. They really couldn't die. Get rid of their bodies, and they'd come back in new ones. Most other pantheons just got a long life in one body, and after they shuffled off their original mortal coil, they could manifest every so often for short periods of time, like the Morrigan did, depending on the power they derived from their believers.
"How exactly will you do that, if I may ask?"
I said, wiping golden gunk off my face. "She obviously can't be trusted. Her word means nothing."
"No, but she can be watched and dealt with, as you just saw.
And if you're too late, if she slips past your guard, if she employs someone else to assassinate me?
You will be safe,
he assured me.
It's a matter of personal honor now. She's given me insult.
I'll leave it in your hands, then, I said, for there was very little else I could do. Though I didn't give voice to them, I already had serious doubts that I would ever be safe from Diana. Whether by design or accident, I'd been outmaneuvered. Jupiter had turned all my leverage to goo. Diana, or one of her proxies, could strike at any time in the future, and then Jupiter's assurances would be meaningless, because I'd be dead. And what would he do if someone were to confront him anyway? Shrug his shoulders and say, "My bad," as Mananon MacLear had already discovered while working with Poseidon and Neptune to search for Jormungandr in the ocean, an entirely fruitless endeavor so far. The Olympians were unreliable allies at best.
"Farewell, Druid," Jupiter said.
I checked my chin at him and braced myself for his exit. It came a split second later in a thunderbolt that made my hair stand on end and burned the air, leaving us alone in the English countryside. Oberon's charged fur stuck out all over, and he shook himself, which got rid of some of Diana's gore but did nothing to improve his appearance.
"I would be okay with never meeting that guy again," he said.
I agreed, and decided my best move would be to impose on Sam and Ty's hospitality until it was time to meet up with Briett. Besides, I needed to leave Oberon somewhere safe. There was no way I'd risk taking him with me to Svartalfheim. Ty's jaw dropped open when he answered the door and saw us standing there in slimy golden glory. "May we use your bathroom, sir?" I asked.
"My God, Atticus, you look like you had an orgy with egg yolks and orange juice."
"Oh, we might need a loofah," I admitted.
"Dare I ask what happened?"
"An Olympian exploded on us, and it was yucky."
"Damn, why can't you get your kicks by base jumping or parasailing, like regular folks?"
"See, Atticus, I keep telling you we should go parasailing."
Ty opened the door wider and stepped aside to let us pass.
"Well, you know where the bathroom is."
"Thanks." "Get in the tub," I told Oberon privately. "But don't you dare wreck the shower curtain this time. I don't care how ugly it is."
"What story are you going to tell me, Atticus?"
"I'm going to tell you about someone who burned down a convent for love."
"Yay! A love story. But I guess not for the love of God."
"That would be an excellent guess." Chapter 9. Contrary to my expectations, I have absolutely no trouble finding the Sisters of the Three Auroras when I get to Warsaw. When I shift into the city with Orla, using a tethered black poplar tree in an expansive park called Pola Mokotowskia, they're waiting for me, having a picnic. All around the tree, in fact, doing it properly with blankets on the grass and baskets full of bread and cheese and pierogies. A few of them have glasses of wine in their hands, which is the sort of thing that is widely practiced, but truly only permissible until the police arrive to issue citations.
"Hey, food," Orla says,
just as Melina Sokolowska raises a half-eaten baguette to hail me around a mouthful of sandwich.
Granuel, welcome."
13 pairs of eyes fix on Orla and me, and it's pretty uncomfortable, because I'm acutely aware of being targeted. I don't really know them that well, except by reputation and a brief meeting. When we were first introduced, I mean the ones that never messed with Atticus and the Tempe pack at Tony Cabin and died for it, Atticus and I had been naked in an onion field near Yasuo, running from Artemis and Diana. The Coven had been waiting for us there because they'd seen something big coming in advance, which turned out to be Loki
rocketing out of the sky to confront us. Pulling the same I-knew-you'd-be-here trick again, except specifically applied to me, only emphasizes why I need shielding from divination. The new coven members had never been introduced to us, and now that I'm possibly at the receiving end of whatever they want to throw my way, I realize I don't know what to expect. Do they use wands to direct their spells? Flailing jazz hands and eyes rolled back in their heads? I remember Atticus saying they're quite fast and skilled in physical combat, but recall very little information in the way of offensive magical attacks. Atticus claims that Melina can summon a hell whip out of the air, but surely I don't need to worry about that in such a public place, especially since I'm not actually from hell, just Kansas.
You're in no danger, I assure you.
Melina continues in her mild Polish accent when I do not reply.
We saw that you wished to talk, and so here we are, enjoying the day. No one will bother us. Please sit.
Orla, I say privately, I know these people but do not trust them yet. Do not accept any food from them.
Oh, okay, but I hope you trust them soon.
Out loud, I say, thank you, and then mutter a binding in Old Irish to keep all my hairs on my head, a precaution that Atticus recommends when dealing with them. I move to take a spot on a blanket to the coven leader's left, but with a basket between us. The nearby witches make minute adjustments so that they can see me better, while the ones on the opposite side of the trunk move so that they have a clear view. They're not dressed alike, to suggest that they're anything but friends, or in any fashion that might suggest they're into the occult. They're wearing clothing appropriate for a sunny but chilly late autumn day. Some wear jeans, others leggings under skirts, with their feet shoved into boots and purple scarves around their necks. Light jackets of varying materials and colors, and a couple of cute knit hats on their heads. Besides Melina, whose long, straight blonde hair instantly identifies her, I think I recognize four other original members by Atticus's shorthand descriptions. Owl-eyed Roxana, Bedhead Claudia, Casimira, who's damn tall, and Cherubic Berta.
Would you like a cucumber sandwich or something to drink?
Berta asks. She has rosy cheeks, and I suspect she might be a bit sloshed, judging by the besotted grin on her face and the nearly empty glass of wine in her hand, with an even emptier bottle nearby.
No, thank you,
I say. I ate recently, and I'm not hungry.
I'd introduce you to everyone, but I expect you're here for business rather than pleasure,
Melina says. When I nod and grimace by way of apology, she smiles in understanding.
We appreciate you being direct and forthright with us. What did you wish to talk about, then?
Your predecessor placed a cloak around Atticus's sword that shielded it from divination. I wonder if you can do the same thing to me.
Yes, we can provide you with a divination cloak, but it's not the sort of thing for which we accept coin.
That's good, because I don't have a single, I was gonna say penny, but you probably don't use those in Poland.
No, we use the groszt for small coins,
one of the witches says. Since her legs appear longer than some people are tall, I think she's Casimira. Don't have a single groszt on me either.
Then you can earn your cloak,
Melina says.
By helping us find the white horse of Sventovit.
I beg your pardon? She's moving quite fast. She probably already knew what I was going to ask, and what she would ask in return.
Sventovit is an old Slavic god of war and divination. There are slightly different spellings and pronunciations of his name, depending on which Slavic country you're in. But he was, or is, important to Polish pagans like ourselves.
And he had a white horse. Did he lose it, or did somebody steal it?
We're not sure.
Why is the horse important? Why isn't Sventovit looking for him?
We are not sure Sventovit is still alive, actually. but we believe that the horse is.
It appears that there are no quick answers to my questions, since I'm missing context. You'd better start at the beginning. Melina turns to one of her coven with overlarge glasses and a thicket of frizzy, dirty blonde hair tamed into a thick ponytail.
Roxana, you're better at this sort of thing. Will you give her the condensed version?
With pleasure.
She smiles primly and swings her giant peepers in my direction.
To the northwest, off the coast of Germany in the Baltic Sea, there is an island called Rügen.
Really? Named after Count Rügen, the six-fingered man?
What? No. Named after the Rujani people, a Slavic tribe that occupied it from the 9th to 12th centuries. The current name is a German corruption.
Oh. On the northeastern tip of the island, at Cape Arkona, there was a fortified cult site called Jarmarsberg. They had a temple there to the god Sventovit. It was the last outpost of Slavic paganism before the Danish king laid siege to it in 1168 and defeated the Rujani. The Danes burned down the temple and the carved idol of Sventovit and forced everyone into Christianity afterward. The Rujani were eventually assimilated into the Germanic tribes nearby, and their language died out in a couple of centuries. But what happened to Sventovit and his horse is what we wish to find out. They disappeared.
You mean they were physically present at Jarmarsberg?
Perhaps not Sventovit himself, but his horse was. Until, we are guessing, immediately before the Danish invasion.
And how do you know this if it was almost 1,000 years ago?
The priests of Sventovit were using the horse to divine victory or defeat in battle. Had the horse been present before the invasion, they would have known about their imminent defeat and abandoned the site.
Forgive me, but I'm not sure that follows. Men have been known to be stupid on occasion, and not listen to sense when their pride is on the line. That's pretty much the history of every war ever.
The witches stare at me, until Claudia snorts in amusement. She's the sleepy-eyed, sensual one, with short, wild hair and a coppery tan. Her lips, soft and poofy like pillows, quirk upward, and they are so beguiling and infinitely kissable that I cannot look away, until Melina says,
Claudia, stop that!
Sorry,
she says, as I blink and shake my head free of the charm.
But it's fun to play with the druids.
I remember Atticus warning me about their charms and telling me that something very similar had happened to him. I see the pattern. Melina wants me to know that her coven could kick my ass if they wanted, but she doesn't want to communicate that herself. She has Claudia do it with those movie star lips of hers and then disciplines her very mildly to give me the impression that she's the fair one who looks out for my well-being. It's the friendliest of threats. Brandishing a pair of delicious lips instead of a weapon, but it's still a threat.
Apologies, Granuel,
Melina says, and then hurries on before I can escalate her message into a confrontation.
The reason we believe the horse is still around has something to do with Loki, which we thought you might find interesting.
Yes, you're right about that.
We haven't confirmed any of this, but it's a mysterious pattern of absences, and we think you might be able to confirm it one way or another. After Loki escaped us, thanks to the strange interference of that Finnish god, we began a series of rituals to try to divine his connections to other pantheons. Do you know of the Slavic god Veles?
No, sorry.
How about Pirun?
Him I know.
Veles is Pirun's nemesis, a sneaky trickster type. The parallel with Thor and Loki is quite clear, in fact. We are fairly certain that Pirun is alive, but not on this earth.
That's correct. He's a guest on the Fey Plains.
Interesting. Thank you. We are less certain about Sventovit. He may be alive, but if so, he's on a distant plane. He might also be dead. Difficult for us to tell either way from what we're sensing. But of Veles we get absolutely nothing. He has been hidden somehow, so we cannot confirm whether he lives or not, much less his whereabouts.
Wait, the Slavic plain was burned by Loki,
I say.
Pirun wondered how Loki could have gained access to it.
Melina nods. You see what we are thinking? Veles is working with Loki.
Loki has a kind of divination shield.
We thought as much. We cannot find him either. We are making guesses based on a series of holes where there should be something present.
So why would... Oh! Maybe a quid pro quo kind of thing is going on. Veles wanted Loki to burn the Slavic plain and almost certainly wanted him to kill Pirun. Partially successful there. And Loki hides Veles so that Pirun and everyone else will assume he's dead. But what would Loki want from Veles in return?
Svantovit and the White Horse, of course.
Hold on. Are you saying Loki wants the White Horse because...
You can ask the White Horse if you will win or lose a battle you begin today, and it will tell you.
Oh, shit! I cry as understanding dawns. He's using the horse to know when to start Ragnarok!
That was our conclusion, also. It would be more accurate on matters of war than any other seer, so we want the White Horse.
Yeah, I think we have the same interests here. We can't have him endlessly bribing allies until he finds the right combination for victory. If Loki's gonna start something, let him be uncertain about it. Can you not find the horse in your divination?
Unfortunately not. It was a long shot to begin with since we didn't know its name. But we assume Loki has shielded it also. Our best guess is that if you find Svantovit alive, he may be able to tell you where to find his horse. And if they are both dead, then Veles must owe Loki some other service.
Where would I begin looking for Svantovit? When was the last time you saw him?
Melina's eyes flicked to Roxana, and I turned to her for my answer.
We have never seen him, she says, nor has anyone in living memory. He has either four heads or four faces on one head, depending on how he manifests. Pretty sure he'd get into the news if he'd been around recently.
Her dry comment earns a laugh from the coven, but it is marvelous news to my hound.
Wow! He could eat four steaks at one time!
But he only has one stomach, Orla. I'd be worried about four sets of teeth to brush. Or what if he got sick? Four stuffed noses? Ew!
Roxana continues. I would suggest looking around Jaromarsburg or speaking with Pirun, if you have access to him. He may be able to provide you with some clues.
I nod, thinking I should talk to him in any case. He'd surely be interested to know Veles is likely allied with Loki. It makes more sense than Loki's assertion that he went after Pirun so hard simply because he despises thunder gods. There are a buttload of thunder gods in the world's pantheons. Why single out Pirun? He must have had cause. And thinking of causes, I had to question why they were so interested in this horse. This is more about giving the finger to Loki than finding the horse, isn't it? The witches all looked to Melina to answer that one. She nodded once.
Both him and Veles. The Zorias do not often spend much of their time on the Slavic plain, but had they been there when Loki set fire to it, they would have been burned. It gives me nightmares, and to think we already had Loki in our power once.
She shook her head.
Well, I would like another chance at that. Or if I can't have him, at least deny him whatever he desires.
All right then, I say and look at Melina.
I find Svantovit, or his horse, but preferably the horse, and either bring it to you or confirm it's dead. And in return, you give me a divination cloak.
Agreed, but with an amendment. If you find Svantovit dead or alive, we would like to know where he is.
I extend my hand to her and say, I accept your proposal. She shakes it, and I smile, because I have a bona fide quest. If he's on another plane, I wouldn't be able to bring him here anyway. Bringing back the horse will be tough enough. Melina's brows draw together.
Why is that?
I only have one other headspace in which to carry someone else when I travel the plains. Right now I've been using that for Orla. I need to memorize a body of work in another language before I can bring someone else along for the ride. It provides structure for the shift, because people are put together in specific sequences like words are in literature. I learned how to speak Russian, but so far their literature is pretty dire and gloomy, and I haven't felt like memorizing any of it.
Shimborska!
Berta blurts out, and the faces of the other witches light up.
Yes,
Roxana says, more excited than I've seen her. She nods so enthusiastically that I fear for her neck.
You should learn Polish and read Szymborska.
I'm sorry, who?
Wisława Szymborska was a Polish poet and a Nobel Prize winner.
Claudia explains.
She wrote about small things, details in life that carry great significance. The English translation I saw in America was a good one. Maybe you should try that. And then, if you like her work, learn to read it in Polish. That's an excellent idea,
Melina says.
Szymborska isn't a dire nihilist.
Thanks for the tip. I'll definitely look into it. I rise to my feet, eager to get on with it. I'll meet you back here when I have something. I'm sure I won't have to tell you when. You'll probably know that before I do. Ha-ha. They laugh politely, but Melina stops me after a couple of steps.
Before you go, Granuel, might you have any idea about when Mr. O'Sullivan plans to make good on his promise to read Poland the Vampires?
Oh, he's working on it, I say, that's for sure.
We know he's been eliminating vampires elsewhere, she replies, but he's not doing it here, where he said he would.
I haven't seen or spoken to him for a while, but I'm sure he hasn't forgotten, and I'm sure he has a plan.
Do remind him for us the next time you speak, won't you?
I will, I promise. See you later, sisters. Enjoy your picnic.
Where are we going now?
Orla asks as we return to the tree.
Germany.
You know, they have sausages in vending machines there?
They do? Germany sounds like a very smart country.
Chapter 10. I didn't tell Oberon how worried I was about him as I ran the bathwater. I just reminded him not to lick his chops until I said it was safe, and to let me know if he felt any pain. I'd had to trigger my healing charm already to combat ichor poisoning. A couple of Diana's bone splinters had cut my skin, and the insidious stuff had entered my bloodstream. Trace amounts like that I could take care of, but if Oberon ingested a mouthful, I'd be hard-pressed to deal with that. Sam and Ty had one of those detachable showerheads with a ringed metal hose that visually suggested a steel caterpillar. Turning the water on full blast to get the most pressure I could, I told Oberon to close his eyes so I could focus on his snout first.
Hey, suffering cat, Radicus, what are you doing?
He protested and squirmed as the water assaulted his snout and began to sluice the ichor away.
Keep still, buddy. We have to get this off you quickly.
You're acting like it's nuclear waste.
It's worse than that.
It is? Then get it off me.
I'm working on it, Oberon.
Tell me that story so I can think about something else.
All right. We're heading back in time to 17th century France, at the court of Louis the 14th.
Did he ever get mad about his name?
What?
Did he ever say, geez, all the names in the world out there, and my family picked Louis 14 times?
I don't think he was embarrassed about it. He was the king.
Oh. Yeah, I guess that would take the sting out of it.
The court of a king is littered with pages waiting to do small errands for the nobility. You're tripping over them quite often, and someone has to train them how to get out of the way and conduct themselves properly. That task fell to the father of our heroine, who trained his daughter with all the pages of the court to fence and take insult and give it right back. Her name was Julie d'Aubigny. And she was married very young to a man named Maupin, who was sent to the south of France for work while she remained in Paris. She was known as Mademoiselle Maupin after that, a famous opera singer, lover, and duelist. She often dressed as a man, but did not disguise her face or do anything else to pretend she was actually male. She sang for her supper in local taverns and participated in fencing exhibitions with a man she traveled with for a while. But when she tired of him, she began a torrid affair with a young woman, and eventually her lover's family found out and decided to solve what they saw as a problem by sending the young woman to a convent. Mademoiselle Maupin did not give up, however. She was in love. She applied to this convent in Avignon herself, taking her vows and reuniting with the young woman. She immediately began plotting their escape and came up with a simple plan. Set something on fire. What she set on fire was the body of another nun, already dead, in the bed of her young lover, thereby covering their escape. They had another 3 months of passion together before their own flame flickered out, and the girl returned to her family. Mademoiselle Maupin, in the meantime, was charged with arson and body snatching, the penalty for which was to be burned alive. She never faced those charges, though. She got pardoned by Louis XIV later, thanks to her connections at court. Mademoiselle Maupin hit the road again, singing, taking a series of male lovers, and occasionally kicking someone's ass in a duel, until she arrived in Paris and joined the opera there. Her life was only mildly tempestuous for a while. She had to beat the hell out of a misogynist actor once, and her landlord on another occasion. But then she landed in serious trouble again when she attended a fancy ball dressed as a man and kissed a young woman there in front of nobility. This was quite offensive according to the social customs of the time, and she was promptly challenged to a duel by 3 different men. She went outside and beat them all, one after the other. While they bled in the street, she went back inside and kissed the girl again. Kissing the girl wasn't the true problem. The problem was that she had very publicly broken the king's law against dueling within the limits of Paris and had to leave the country for a time. She relocated to Brussels, sang in the opera there, had several more affairs, and then returned to France, where she sang in the Paris opera until 1705. Her final affair was with a woman who died in an untimely fashion, and she took her lover's death quite hard and retired from the opera altogether. She entered a convent, in fact, and died a couple of years later at the young age of 33. It was a short, violent, but passionate life she led. She didn't give a damn about gender roles, and she kissed and fought whomever she felt like kissing or fighting. And she sang beautifully and snatched bodies when she needed to. That was Julie Daubigny, or Mademoiselle Maupin.
Wow, Vadicus, she was awesome. Did you ever meet her?
I did not meet her personally, but I did see her perform Tancred at the Paris Opera in 1702.
Was she good?
Oh, she was very good. And you are very good. We almost have all this gunk off you. How are you feeling?
Something stings pretty bad on my right shoulder. The front, I mean.
I examined the area, parting the fur with my fingers, and found a shallow scratch from a bone splinter there. I'd taken the brunt of it, but Oberon hadn't escaped completely. There was some yellow discoloration around the scratch, which meant that it had indeed been ichor covered, and some of it had managed to get into Oberon. I would have to directly heal him, or else it would get worse. Ichor poisoning functioned like cancer, in that it turned a mortal body against itself, and even small amounts could be fatal eventually. There wasn't an herbal remedy for it that I knew of, so I'd have to break it down inside him, as I'd done to myself. Okay, you're cut up here. Don't shake yourself off or talk or anything. I need to concentrate to deal with this. Just let me know when it stops stinging. Directly healing another creature by the old laying on of hands is always a tricky business. The Hippocratic maxim of first do no harm is especially true when it comes to using Gaia's energy, since she frowns rather severely on using the Earth's magic to do any direct injury. But finding what was not Oberon and was clearly invasive wasn't that difficult. It simply required patience and thorough attention. It turned out there were only a few milligrams of ichor inside him. Nothing to send him into shock or seizures now, but enough to do the job eventually if I didn't stop it. Unbinding the molecular chains of the ichor into their components left a few random proteins coursing through him. They would eventually get flushed out, and render the rest of it inert. Oberon was shivering by the time I was finished.
It stopped stinging, Atticus, but I'm cold and wet now.
Okay, buddy, sorry that it took so long. You can shake off now and roll around on a towel. I have to trade places with you and wash myself. Once I scoured myself several times, and my skin stung all over with the raw thrill of exfoliation, we emerged damp but refreshed from the bathroom. I borrowed Ty's phone to call Hal Houck and tell him my Sean Flanagan identity was toast. I'm going to need a new set of papers, I told him.
I'm going to need money for that, and you can't afford it anymore,
he said.
Your accounts are drier than a high desert well since Drasha got access through Kodiak Black and emptied them. You're going to owe me.
Understood. I'm good for it, Hal. It's this war with the vampires. It's so very draining.
Gods.
Hal's voice was weary.
I sentence you to 3 centuries in pun prison for that.
You are the very best of attorneys.
Yeah.
How's the Oregon deal progressing? Kodiak Black hadn't managed quite everything of mine, and that's where most of my remaining funds had gone. A cabin property in the Willamette National Forest. For me, the entire point of building up multiple accounts had always been for precisely this purpose, to pay for a new hiding place the next time I had to run. I couldn't flip houses. I had to abandon them along with my identity every time I ran, and that took cash. Once we had our new safe house settled, I wouldn't need to impose on anyone else.
Almost finished. Few more days. I'll bring your ID up to Flagstaff when it's ready.
Thanks, Hal. We rang off, and I turned to find Sam and Ty standing behind me, arms crossed and staring as if I'd trespassed somehow. What did I do? I asked.
You tell us, Sam said. Which Olympian's ichor did you just wash down our drain?
Diana's? Sam's eyebrows shot up.
The Huntress, Diana, you have on your trail? A trail that leads to our door?
I certainly hope not. Jupiter said he'd take care of it.
Jupiter can't even control his own urges,
Ty pointed out.
What makes you think he'll be able to rein in Diana's?
He echoed my own worries about the situation, but I didn't want to openly agree. Look, fellas, I'm leaving in a few minutes. I have this thing to do with Breed on one of the Norse planes. If Diana shows up, and that's a big if, you're welcome to tell her I'm in Svartalfheim. Sam's jaw dropped in disbelief.
You're seriously going to visit the Dark Elves?
It's either that or displease the Morrigan.
I really don't want to annoy the chooser of the slain,
but I can't take Oberon with me. It's too dangerous. I clasped my hands together and gave them my best, pleading, hopeful expression.
Hey, wait, what? You're leaving me here?
I have to. Svartalfheim is no place for a hound. It's no place for a druid, either. Sam shook his head, and Ty sighed.
You really are a giant pain in the arse. Like Owen says,
I'll find a way to make it up to you, I promised.
Oh, no. We'll think up something ourselves,
Ty countered. Thank you very sincerely for watching him. But I gotta warn you guys, after the bath time story I just told him, Oberon may try to hump your leg and then challenge you to a duel. Or vice versa.
Chapter 11. I've had a few days to prepare, but me palms are sweaty when I see the families approaching from the house. I hope I look competent to their modern eyes, and not like some wild cock-up of a man. I'm in a robe, since I plan to be shape-shifting, and my bare feet are chilled, while the rest of me feels overheated. Sam and Greta are with the group, and they smile at me, happy over what is to begin here. But the families and the children look as nervous as I feel. Or maybe they're just tired. They all had long trips to get here on short notice. Not a one of them looks Irish, or anything close to it. And I think that's grand. It's best, methinks, to have druids from all over Gaia. That way they'll each have a special stretch of the earth calling to their hearts. It's what we should have done back in the old days, if we'd been thinking properly. But instead of actively trying to spread druidry everywhere, we just assumed it would grow outward from Ireland and keep going. They never got out of the European continent, and that's a mistake we don't need to repeat. I'm standing a good distance from the house in a field of bunch grass, already gone dormant for the winter. Pines stand tall behind me, in formations leading up the mountain, and the air is crisp. There are worse places I could start a grove. Greta presents me to them all, and I nod once and say, "Welcome." I get a few nods and a couple of shy smiles in return. Then the introductions begin. First is a married couple and a wee girl from some place called Mongolia. They have a translator with them while they're learning English. But Greta assures me that she's pack also. Straight dark hair, high cheekbones, golden brown complexions. The father, Nergui, is the new pack member. His wife's name is Oyunchi Meg, but she wants to simply be called Meg in the United States. The girl is 7. And her name is Ishtuya. The parents get nods, but I squat down on me haunches, so I'm not so large and intimidating, and grin at the girl, who wants to be called Tuya. "Nice to meet ye, Tuya," I says. And she relays a polite reply via the translator. Next in line is a family from Peru. Both of the parents, Diego and Rafaela, are new pack members and are very worried about protecting their boy, Oscar. They speak English with a charming accent and have warm brown skin and thick black eyebrows. Oscar is a shy lad and doesn't respond to my greeting except after prompting from his parents. He might be a bit small for his age, a bit thin. Time and oats will take care of it. Mohammed and his son, Mehdi, hail from a village in the mountains of Morocco, a place called Chefchaouen, which is rather fun to say out loud. The boy's mother is missing, but I don't inquire about it right then. She may be in the house or simply elsewhere, and if not, there is plenty of time to collect such stories later. They are dressed in white, and Muhammad has a little cap on his head that I suspect has some kind of religious significance. I'm not up to speed on all the religions that have sprung up since me own day, but it really doesn't matter. Gaia doesn't require worship, so druids can pray to whomever they want.
"Thank you for doing this," Mohammed says. "I don't want to outlive my son. If Mehdi becomes a druid, he can live longer, yes? Like wolves?"
"That's right," I tell him. "Though I leave out that this is a recent development, thanks to Sheehan. I know I don't look like it, but I'm in my 70s. Mohammed clasps his hands together and says something in a language I don't recognize, as he lowers his head in what I assume is a prayer of thanks. One of the monotheist religions, I'm guessing. The religion of Sajit, however, is a serious problem for him now that he's a werewolf, as his translator explains. He's a Hindu from Nepal, and this has something to do with why he's a strict vegetarian. Yet when he shifts once a month, his wolf won't let him shift back without eating meat, which he finds very distressing. He wants to make it very clear, therefore, that his daughter, Amita, should not be forced to eat meat as part of her apprenticeship. "You both can eat what you want," I says to him, and shrug. "It doesn't matter to me." Amita's mother is absent as well, and the wee girl is reluctant to make eye contact. Her complexion is lighter than her father's, tawny, where his is a warm sepia. But I can tell she's going to be tall like him. Luis is an earnest 6-year-old from Brazil, and missing his father. His mother, Natalia, greets me in broken English. They have a translator, but clearly already know a few words. Luis has a gap between his front teeth. It makes me like him. The last family is a father and daughter from Zambia, and they possess skin of a deep, rich umber. Their hair is cropped very close to their skulls. The girl is by far the tallest of the children, though I'm unsure if that's simply because she's older than the rest, or if she's truly above average. The father, Songwe, is fluent in English, and his daughter, Tandy, is learning well. I note that her eyes take in everything. When she's finished absorbing me, her eyes drift to the trees as her father speaks, volunteering why he's a single parent.
"After I was bitten," he says, "my wife left us. She thinks I'm a monster now."
If she truly thinks that, then I wonder why she would leave her child with a monster. But I keep my questions in reserve. Now is not the time for them. "There isn't a one of ye that's a monster," I says, and nod to the translators to indicate that they should relay my words. "You're just bound to lycanthropy now. Fancy word for a certain kind of binding. All magic is a binding of some kind, and druids are bound to the earth, to Gaia." I'd stood to meet the other children after Tuya, but I go ahead and squat again so that the kids would know I was speaking to them and not their parents. I pull up my right sleeve to reveal my tattoos, then speak to the apprentices, sweeping my eyes across them in turn. "This ink is not for decoration. It's my binding to the earth, and that, in turn, allows me to bind myself to 4 animal shapes and do many other things besides. When you are ready, you will be bound to the earth in the same way, and then you will be able to shape-shift into far different creatures. But a druid's shape-shifting is different from a werewolf's. It's faster, painless, and we don't have to do it at all if we don't want to. But you're probably going to want to. Wouldn't you like to fly?" The kids nod and I smile. "Sure, who wouldn't? One of your shapes will be a bird of some kind. I'll show you in a minute." My eyes flick over to Greta, and she nods, encouraging me to continue. She coached me on what to do next, warning me about modern cultural standards of modesty. "The thing about shape-shifting is, you can't do it with your clothes on. Or if you do, it's mighty painful and you can hurt yourself. Better to get rid of your clothes first, and get rid of any shame about your body while you're at it. The shape you are born with is perfect in Gaia's eyes. That should be good enough for anybody." I rise from my crouch and say, "I'm going to shape-shift to a red kite now, just to show you what I'll have you working for in the years ahead." all the language schooling, all the mental exercises, and all the physical training will be to get you ready for the responsibility. But make no mistake, it's fun.